Welcome to Cancel Culture, the Business of Love podcast brought to you by Byfield. Welcome to the first episode of Cancel Culture, the Business of Love podcast brought to you by Byfield. My name is Meg Tilley. I'm a former legal journalist, and I am today joined by Michael Evans, who has been with us for a year, but was previously for a number of years in-house at big law firms in the city. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Meg.
How are you doing?
Good, thank you. It's good to be here. We thought that it would be good to have a bit of a chat every week about some of the stories, some of the biggest stories in the business of law, legal sector, and just talk through them.
Yeah, and I think the first one, I mean, we need to talk about the elephant in the room. Today we're recording when Liz Truss has resigned literally 2 hours ago. So I think we have to talk about this and kind of how it may impact big law here in the UK. I mean, what are your thoughts?
It's been an extraordinary month in British politics. And, you know, I was quietly backing the lettuce over Liz. And... should have put some more money on. I think that more seriously, though, if we look at what's happened in the last couple of hours, the bond markets have stabilised. The pound is up a bit, has held on to its gains. The markets have, in effect, been running the country for the last few weeks. And now, with Truss gone, they seem happier. God knows what's going to happen over the next week or so. But it can probably only get better from here. And I don't think legal business is any different from any other business sector in that stability is generally good. Law firms are good at profiting from good times and bad, but you need to have a degree of certainty to be able to run your business. You need to have some idea of what tax rate you're going to pay, what corporation tax rate is going to be, what the individual tax rate is going to be, you know, who's making the laws, all of those basic things that underpin not just an economy, but also a legislative system. And all of that has been so uncertain the last few weeks. I don't think that it was sustainable. And I'm certain that everybody in the legal sector will be breathing a sigh of relief that Truss is gone.
Yeah, I agree. But then again, you have to question who's going to be next and whether they will definitely be a better option. I don't think anyone could have seen what's happened economically in the past month coming at all so quickly, especially. I think it was quite a shock to everyone. And responding to that would have been really difficult. So I don't know. I mean, we did see that. We put out a report last week that kind of fears around how to manage your business when a recession is coming up and the cost of living were really high up on managing partners' concerns. And I'm not sure if the uncertainty of what's happening next is going to help with that. What do you think?
I think that's right. I mean, certainly running a business in a period of high inflation, managing rising costs, trying to keep hold of staff are all incredibly difficult issues. You've kind of got both full employment, tight labour markets, and a recession and high inflation sort of all coming together, and it's the most bizarre thing. So more uncertainty on one hand is probably not helpful, but we've had so much in the past few weeks. It does depend who the new leader is. It does depend. I mean, I can't see if it's Boris Johnson, but it's going to be particularly helpful to anybody. And whoever comes in is going to need a proper democratic mandate at some point to be able to take the difficult decisions that need to be taken.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to see more tax rises or cuts to spending, but some of both of those things are probably likely to happen. And it's going to be difficult, and we're going to need a mandate from the electorate to be able to do those things. And, you know, businesses will, I think, the businesses, including in the legal sector, will feel more comfortable when there is a stable government with a mandate, even if the decisions that are being taken are difficult ones.
Yeah.
I mean, who do you think is going to be the next prime minister, Meg?
I have no idea. I don't think it's something anyone can predict. I would not put money on that right now, to be honest. It's really hard to tell. But it would be nice if it was a general election rather than another, you know, conservative Tory that's not elected by everyone in the country. Anyway, let's move on to, we're still going to talk about the cost of living crisis. There was a fairly nice story in the news this week in the FT about Hagen Novels funding and doing some pro bono work for a charity to help people with their cost of living, really, and get by. I thought that was such a kind of really nice project to do, and I wonder what other firms are doing in this sphere. We've not heard much from anyone else, really. I mean, any thoughts?
Look, I think there's a couple of different things here. I think the role of lawyers, the role of the legal sector in helping people who are perhaps in less fortunate positions, people in poverty, people struggling, is there. That on the one hand, you have the pro bono side of things in terms of actual legal advice, where there's the catastrophic underfunding of access to justice has had such an enormous impact over the last decade or so. I mean, we sponsor the Commercial Litigators Forum, which is all about promoting better access to justice and, you know, some kind of rationality to the basics of our legal system, ensuring that the people who need legal advice can get it. And that just isn't happening at the moment. I thought it was really nice to see the story. But in the same way that individual instances of lawyers doing something and individual instances of pro bono are great and better than nothing, they're not a solution. And something which was, I suppose, sector-wide or even perhaps government-backed would be better than the sort of piecemeal support that we see. That is not to say that it isn't fantastic to see firms stepping up and doing their bit, whether it's helping benefits claimants navigate paperwork or pro bono legal advice for poorest in society. What do you think, Meg?
I mean, I think that was a nice story. I'm kind of surprised because during the pandemic, I remember when we were reporting on, you know, firms giving their PPE equipments to hospitals and things like that. Suddenly we had maybe like one or two at first telling us about this. And then when other firms saw that a couple of firms had done it, all of a sudden they were putting out press releases, like everyone was doing the same thing and wanted to get a story for themselves, for their own reputation. And I think what Hagen Novels is doing is really nice. And it would be nice to see other firms doing something similar, even though it's not a solution to the bigger issue of the cost of living. But what I'm also scared about is how honest some firms doing that kind of stuff would be. And if we were to see more firms doing that kind of stuff, it would be nice. But at the same time, if they're doing it for their own kind of advertisement or, you know, to look good.
I think that's a good point. I think there is a degree of both, A, following the herd in our sector, of course there is. But also you've got to find the right line between showcasing something genuinely good and seeking cheap PR for something. I absolutely don't think that's the case here with the firms mentioned. But it obviously is something that can be a risk. You don't want to overdo profiling something that you're doing just because it's a little bit of good. It should be good for its own sake.
Yeah.
However, drawing attention to what you are doing, if it is good, can in fact, you know, make other firms think, oh, we need to be doing more.
Yeah.
Are we doing more? And I think the key thing is, if you're thinking, are we doing more? Could we be doing more? That's the right response. What's the wrong response would be, oh, we need to get PR for our things too.
Yeah.
So I think this is one of those things. It's a public interest story in certain respects.
For sure.
Not a not really a business of law. And the question is, can it spark conversation, debate about what more the sector can do here to support people who are really badly impacted by the cost of living crisis? Because let's face it, city law firms are not.
I agree. I think that's a really good point that you're raising. I mean, if it starts a conversation, then why not? But yeah, I am scared that if we have any other firms following up on that, it might turn into more of a kind of, PR exercise for their own sake. But I guess for now, we're not seeing that. So I guess that's kind of nice about it. I'm a bit cynical because, I mean, you know, I've been on the other side of the fence, so I kind of saw that more than enough. Another story that we saw this week was that was on The Lawyer. ShoeSmith asking its partners to pay £200 on top of their plane tickets when they're choosing to travel by plane, which is an interesting ESG initiative. I thought that was very innovative, but I think also it's the type of firm that can do it because of the locations that they've got. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how the partners are currently reacting to this, but I think it would be interesting to see what the rest of the market thinks. I mean,
I think it's really interesting that there's been a lot of talk in terms of ESG and in terms of climate change. And it was something that sort of sorted itself out a bit during the pandemic because travel became impossible. So every firm out there, every business out there hit its targets in reducing travel, but it was very much through forced change. Now it's much more a case of can you take your commitments forward into a more normal environment where there are pressures to travel. And you're quite right, but for some firms this will be relatively easy. For big global firms or firms doing huge amounts of cross-border work, it can be harder. Doing the work is perhaps not so much the problem, because we all learned that you can do cross-border international work remotely during the pandemic. That's fine. It's the client relationships, it's the business development, it's the staying close to your clients, that sort of thing that is difficult to do and maintain over time. And also for younger lawyers to be able to get exposure to that international business culture, a certain amount of travel is probably vital. So it's a question of how you find the right way to do that. Adding a bit of an extra bill probably isn't going to make a huge amount of difference. It's more a case of getting people thinking about whether a trip is necessary. Can they do it by train? Again, that's very difficult in a high time pressure, hours-based charging culture like the legal sector, where time is really, really important, and busy people, whether partners, associates, trainees, you know, the idea that they will spend 6 hours on a train when it's an hour as opposed to an hour flight is probably unrealistic. But thinking about limiting their travel and not automatically jumping on a plane all the time is really important. I mean, this particular initiative, who knows? I don't think that just making very highly paid people pay a surcharge for a flight is going to make a vast amount of difference in the long run. But anything that gets people thinking about it and considering whether they really need to get on that plane, maybe at the edges, is helpful.
I agree. I think during the pandemic, that's one of the good sides of it, if I can say, is that, all of a sudden, a lot of firms were a lot more conscious about their own ESG credentials and how to be more climate friendly, which is really good. But then as we're going back to the normal now, you would expect sometimes clients to ask someone to fly all the way to New York for a 2-hour meeting and that kind of stuff. And I think it's about, really asking yourself, like, if it's an initiative to really get people to think about their own impact on the planet, I guess that's really, really helpful for sure, because you would think twice before spending that extra £200. I mean, I'm not sure if clients on their side would would necessarily care about that because the cost is not on them anyway. Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I mean, I thought that was really innovative.
Just to finish off, I mean, I think there's going to be a general trend, which we see coming out, I think, across the business press, which applies just as much to the legal sector, is can you walk the walk in terms of ESG and commitment to combating climate change, even when it means taking difficult decisions that may have an impact on your business?
Yeah.
And I think the jury is still out on business as a whole. Nobody wants to fall behind their competitors because, you know, again, it's a very, there's a herd mentality at play in sectors. And if all your competitors are going somewhere to do something, you want to be there too. And it's hard, it's really difficult to take those decisions not to travel. But it's going to be an essential part of complying with your obligations for all the promises that you've made. And those promises might be they might be legally binding, they might be not at all legally binding, but they're commitments that you've made to your people.
I agree. I think a lot, like the younger generation of lawyers that's incoming, I think a lot of them will care a lot more about these types of initiatives. And I think GCs as well. I think like all the D&I stuff and ESG things, like it's a lot of it comes from GCs asking their law firms to do better in that space, which is great. But I think it's a good start to the whole debate, but I think, I'd like to see what bigger firms will do in that space. If anyone will be willing to implement something similar or, you know, what else can be done really to limit travel.
Transparency, I think, is going to be crucial. So bigger firms, you know, they do put out annual reports in terms of impact, or at least some of them do. And some of that is already does include details of travel, flights, carbon emissions. So having it's not going to be instant, and in a way, the process, I think, the progress was interrupted by the pandemic because we had everything stopped and then everything goes again, and people are trying to catch up.
Yeah.
So in a way, we've sort of lost a bit of ground, even though firms travelled much less, because the initiatives that were progressing have had the sort of steam come out of them. There's a bit of a desire to just reconnect, which is completely human, completely understandable.
For sure.
So people are desperate to travel and have been traveling a lot, and that's completely understandable. I don't think anybody should be penalized for that. The other problem is that the data doesn't really map onto anything because you had everything stopped, so of course flights, carbon emissions all dropped. So the data that firms collect about their own businesses, you know, suddenly a year on, it looks like it's went down and then it's shot up. It's going to be a year or two before we've got anything meaningful. So I kind of do think, although the climate emergency is an emergency, it is also a long run thing, and I think firms are going to need a little bit of time to reconnect with what they're trying to achieve here. So any progress is good, but I don't think we should judge firms too harshly for wanting to see their clients.
No, I agree. I agree. I think that's a key part for them at the moment, to be able to reconnect with them after 2 years. The next story is from law.com, and that was a really interesting one. It followed a first story that they published, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago about whether younger lawyers and associates were entitled and because they don't want to work as hard as previous generations. And so that feature this week was discussing exactly that and asking current partners, looking back at their lives, as to whether they regretted any of their decisions to work, you know, all night long and you know, maybe put family second to work and that kind of stuff. So I thought that was super interesting, and really in tune with what the new generation is kind of asking for. I mean, you've been in the business for a while. I mean, what do you think is currently happening? I think there's a major generational gap here that older partners might not understand why younger lawyers are not doing the same thing they did.
I thought this was a really interesting piece. Older partners looking back at work-life balance. I think there's some stories here about individual partners talking about not seeing much of their kids, but also how much they enjoyed the sort of thrill of the work. I think one thing to really remember is that nobody, I don't believe anybody on their deathbed has ever or will ever think, oh God, I wish I'd spent more time in the office.
Oh, for sure.
So, I think you do start to reflect on these things a bit differently as you get older. Certainly, there is more competition for talent now.
Yeah.
So I think that whereas 20 years ago, when I was a journalist, actually first writing about the legal sector, there were certain times during boom times talent shortages, but nothing like the pressures we see now. So I think there's a bit of the fight between the leaders of businesses and the workers in a business, whether, and that this could apply to, you know, to a law firm or frankly a coffee shop in West London at the moment.
Yeah.
As things have woken up and accelerated, particularly post-pandemic, workers, whether they are, again, working in the service industry or working in the legal industry or accountancy or banking or private equity, there's a huge need for them to be, for those people, and difficulty keeping hold of them. So they have more power. So it's different. The context is different. They can ask for more and get it. And I think that's really the crucial thing, is that what they want has to be listened to in a way that, frankly, taking a really basic capitalist look at things, you don't have to. When you've got plenty of people and they all want a job with this prestigious law firm, and you're just picking off these few, and you don't have a vast amount of pressure to keep hold of them to attract them into business in the first place, it's kind of easier to just have a slightly less sensitive approach to it. I think now business leaders, managers in the legal sector, any people-driven business, are very sensitive to the fact that they need their people to be engaged, to want to work there, and that money itself is not just part of the picture. And I think that's changed. But I did feel a bit sad looking at reading some of the stories, you know, the sort of working very long hours, 8 months pregnant.
That's horrible. It's horrible.
I mean, what did you take away from the piece, Meg?
I mean, I feel like a generation of partners that worked when emails were not really a thing, and you know, like I feel like it's not the same way of working either. And I think it's really hard to compare it, but I think it would be harsh for older generations to impose the same lifestyle that they had 20 or 30 years ago on the incoming generation of lawyers who don't need to do that anymore because we've got technology. To me, it sounds counterproductive to me. I'm one of those people that totally agrees with the associates on a lot of that stuff. But at the same time, when you see how much they're getting paid at some of these firms, you also have to think, well, do you have any space to complain when you're making, you know, 200K a year? I'm not sure.
It's a good point you make about productivity, though, because a huge amount of technological progress has boosted productivity by a vast amount. If you think about the amount of things that you can do now, and I'm probably the last generation that had an analog childhood and a digital adulthood. So I can actually remember handwriting essays and not having a mobile phone and stuff. And the productivity gains have been enormous. So Do we gain efficiency only to be able to work harder? Well, at what point do we get a bit of life back? And I think there's a bit of inherent tension there.
Yeah.
And some of it is self-selecting. If you're working with bankers and private equity deal makers who are driving themselves incredibly hard, they're going to have like high expectations.
Yeah.
But there, you're talking about a small amount of, a relatively small amount of people there. And when we talk about salary hikes, I think it's a little bit unfair, really, because what you've seen at the junior end are huge hikes.
Yeah.
And you've seen profitability hikes, which benefit the equity partners.
Right, yeah.
But in the middle, there's been a lot of compression. Mm. So whereas it used to be that, you know, a two-year qualified might earn 90 grand, but then somebody who's six-year qualified might make 170. Now, you know, the gap between that 1 or 2 years qualified and 5 or 6 or 8 years qualified is relatively small.
Yeah.
So it's that group in the middle that I kind of wonder a little bit about
how they're finding it.
Yeah.
I feel like at the same time as well, I feel like more importantly, if you can't keep your people happy on the point of productivity, your teams are just not going to get along. They're not going to be motivated and happy about the work that they do. And I think in the long term, you just lose out. We're going to move to the last story, which was on The Guardian and several other legal trades. And it was about how there were only 90 out of 13,000 black partners at law firms across England and Wales, which is sadly not surprising but shocking nonetheless, because you would think that at this point firms would have maybe made it easier to progress your career as a black lawyer, or just even in terms of recruitment. And I'm not sure where the problem is coming from exactly in terms of at what stage of their career something is going wrong for them to not access the partnership as easily as their white counterparts. What do you think?
I think there's a couple of different things at play here. One is, you know, owner managed businesses, law firms, where there is quite a long partnership track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen it with gender diversity. Ethnicity is not different. You do get change, but it takes time.
Yeah.
You cannot legally boot out a bunch of partners for being, you know, perceived to be the wrong color or gender
for
and
sure.
Just replace. That's not how it works. So the reality of the sector is that change happens slowly over time. The question is that change happening? And if it is happening, even if it's slow, because of the nature of the industry, you can sort of say there is progress here and there is change. Whether there is enough or not, I don't know. I mean, I personally am of a view that a commitment to diversity means nothing unless you've got a strong commitment to social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Because, frankly, it doesn't really matter what gender or colour somebody is. If they went to private school, had hugely wealthy family, money, etc. You're just swapping people from vast privilege
yeah.
in and out. And I think you do have that commitment. You do need to have a commitment to social mobility in terms of your recruitment, how you assess people, how you promote people. And if you have that, then the other aspects of diversity come into play. I personally, this is my personal opinion, think it's all a bit meaningless unless you have put that commitment to social mobility first.
I agree, but I don't think you necessarily need to tackle it at different times. I think all of these different things can be tackled at the same time, but obviously some of these will take longer than others. But if you're putting in the work from the start at recruitment and promotion level, and training level and all that stuff, for whether you're, you know, from a working class family or you're an ethnic minority or you're non-binary or whatever the case may be, I don't think we should prioritize what is more urgent than anything else. I think it should all kind of be equally kind of funded and kind of worked for, really, if that makes sense. Did you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I think you need to have the Guardian piece itself notes that 3.3% of the population of England and Wales, so black people constitute 3.3% of the population of England and Wales, but only 1% of partners at major law firms in the UK.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to have something which is at least equivalent to that. So,
yeah.
So that would suggest that there needs to be significant growth in that number to just to reflect society.
Yeah.
It's never going to be perfect, but you want it to be at least going in the right direction. I don't know at the moment whether there's enough solid data, robust data to show if it is. Ethnicity reporting is still a bit patchy.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think firms, in my experience, firms are very well-meaning in this regard. However, there is still the tendency for people to hire to want to work with or to automatically prioritize, often unconsciously, people from similar backgrounds to them. So you do still have Oxbridge heavily, you know.
For sure.
So I think that it's not necessarily, and so if you have Black people underrepresented in those groups, it doesn't feed through into change as quickly as it should. We've had all sorts of unconscious bias training in the sector, but the reality is there is a certain amount of, I suppose, privilege which has historically been associated with the legal sector, and conscious effort in an industry that by definition changes over time because of a long track to partnership, you know, needs to be sustained over a long period of time. And although it's easy to get frustrated with the industry and justifiably so in some respects, it is about incrementally, is it changing? Is it getting better? And how then do you accelerate that in a way which is appropriate and realistic?
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. Any ideas?
No, me either. And I think it's a really difficult issue for firms to tackle. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way, but yeah, I think it's just a lot of different brains thinking at different angles for this. But anyway, that was the last story of the day. So thank you for joining me.
That's my pleasure. And, it was fun. Are we doing it again next week?
Yes, of course. Don't forget to tune in next week for the second episode.
You've been listening to Council Culture, the Business of Law podcast brought to you by Byfield. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and join us again next week, where we'll be discussing some more of the biggest stories in the legal sector.